You are listening to Radio Aryan.
Welcome to Aryan Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 18th of March, 2019, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAryan.com. Well, I'm very pleased to say that we have with us once again Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, how are you doing today?
I'm absolutely fine, yes. I've got a little bit of the snuffles today. I must have picked a cold up from somebody over the last few days. But other than that, I'm absolutely fine, and it's a reasonably bright but slightly sort of lightly spitting with rain kind of day where I am.
Yeah, it does seem to the weather sort of broken a little bit. There's quite a bit of rain. I think there's been floods in the Conwy Valley in Wales and elsewhere in Britain. And there's also been lots and lots of double crossing and problems happening in Parliament this week. They seem to have reached an impasse. Last week we spoke about the three votes that they were going to be having on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, and each one of those votes went off the way that we predicted it. Theresa May lost the vote on her deal for the second time on her withdrawal agreement, and then on the Wednesday, the traitors in Parliament voted to take the no-deal Brexit off the table, which is basically the World Trade Organization agreement, which 90% of the world trade with. They actually use that agreement. They voted to take that off the table, which is also the only bargaining chip Theresa May has. And then on the Thursday, they voted to ask the EU to extend Article 50 to basically keep Britain in the EU. And then since then, we've also been told that Theresa May is going to put her deal before Parliament for the third time. For the third time now, she's basically saying you have to vote for this. She's made no changes to it. And now she's making threats. She's saying if they don't vote for her deal, then we will be staying in the EU for the foreseeable future, which is just blackmail, basically. And she has said 108 times, she's on record saying that if people don't vote for her deal, we will be leaving on March the 29th without a deal. 108 times she has said this. And yet she herself voted on the Thursday to take no deal off the table. And it's just open treason that this woman is engaged in against the country. As well as saying if we don't vote for her deal, then we're never going to get out of the EU. She's also apparently been trying to bribe Conservatives by saying that she will give a leave date and she will step down. But that's no compensation for still being stuck within the EU. So the only way that I see it now is if the EU itself comes to our rescue, because if they want to delay Article 50, they need to have a unanimous decision from all the leaders of Europe. They all have to okay that and say, yes, that's okay. Britain can stay within the EU. So I am hoping and praying that our friends Salvini and Viktor Orban, maybe they'll have the courage to veto it and say, no, the British people voted for this and we support democracy. We are democratic countries. We support democracy and we're going to veto this, so that Britain does have to leave on March the 29th, because that's what we're down to now. We are now down to other countries having to save our democracy and save our belief in democracy. That's the only way that Brexit can be saved now, is if somebody like Salvini or Viktor Orban or maybe even the Polish Prime Minister. I mean, it could be one of the Czech Republic Prime Minister. If just one of them is all is required, if they say, no, we don't want Britain to stay within the EU, they voted to leave, then we will still have to leave on March the 29th. So that's what I'm praying for anyway. What are your views on this, Max?
Well, I pretty much agree with you, actually. I think that what's been done is dastardly. I think right from the very beginning, it was fairly evident that the majority of MPs wanted us to stay in the European Union, and they pretty much declared their position right at the very beginning, just after the referendum had been held, that they were going to do everything in their power to frustrate the Brexit process and to prevent us and to try and manoeuvre us into a situation where we'd have to have a second vote that they, after a period of time during which they obviously would continue with the media to bully us into making a decision to remain in the European Union. And so it's a constitutional crisis which is on a par with the abdication of Edward VIII, or perhaps even on a par with the confrontation between King John and the nobleman when the Magna Carta was signed. It's that kind of a situation, and it's one where the elected members of Parliament have shown their complete disrespect for democracy by placing their wishes ahead of the democratically expressed wishes of the British people. And you know, it is a constitutional crisis. That there's no other way choice about it. But it very clearly demonstrates the way in which our MPs over successive decades now have completely disregarded the wishes of the British people expressed in all sorts of opinion polls, where whenever there's been a poll taken on issues such as immigration, for example, the majority of British people have far greater controls on immigration. They've wanted immigration to be strictly limited, and yet politicians have contrived to create a legal and legislative situation where there is uncontrolled immigration into this country. It's, you know, exactly the same sort of thing. Whenever things like capital punishment are discussed, the vast majority of our people believe that capital punishment has its place in our legal system, and yet MPs consistently disregard the public wishes and capital punishment's been abolished for many decades now. And the same sort of situation exists with regard to euthanasia. My belief is that the vast majority of people believe that it is right that if somebody has reached the end of their life and they're in constant pain and they want to be allowed to die, that they should be allowed to die. And yet, again, politicians have interfered, and politicians have stated that they know better than the public. And here we are in a situation now where very sort of frail and terminally ill people are forced to make a very sort of arduous journey over to Switzerland in order to attend a clinic there where they can have an assisted death. And it's just the latest in a whole catalogue of things where Parliament has disregarded the wishes of the British people. And sooner or later, a point is going to be reached where the British people are going to say enough. And it can't come soon enough for me, to be quite honest.
Well, it may come within the next couple of weeks. I mean, I hear that all the lorry drivers are preparing to block all the roads up on the 29th if we don't actually leave. And all the support, the public support, is with the government leaving on the 29th and doing exactly what they said they would do. I think the businesses, the corporations, I think they're fed up of this. I mean, even if they had wanted to stay within the EU, they would have been better off if we just left the day after having the referendum. We were told that David Cameron said that he would be activating Article 50 the day after the referendum. And here we are almost 3 years later. They're still arguing about making some kind of deal. We rejected David Cameron's deal. We didn't say we vote for another deal. We said, no, we reject the deal. We just want to leave. We've told them this. We told them in no uncertain terms. 17 million people voted for it. The question was very, very simple. It wasn't, do you want to do a deal? It was, do you want to leave? And we're still here. We still haven't left. And we're now forced to look to the other members of the EU to save our democracy. Now, if we do end up staying within the EU, then I think we are going to see huge support for the Eurosceptic nationalist parties. Tommy Robinson has already said that he will stand for UKIP in that case. Jacob Rees-Mogg has already spoken about this as well. He said that if we do stay within the EU, there will have to be EU elections. If there are EU elections, then Tommy Robinson will be in the European Parliament, which I think would be great. You know, I would like to see that. I mean, the British government are stuffed either way. If they don't leave, they're going to end up losing, because there will have to be European elections. I mean, they can't have Britain as being a part of the European Union without any actual representation there. And these elections are supposed to be taking place in May. So, of course, this is going to also infuriate the other members of the EU. They want to be holding their elections in May. They don't want to be messing around with Britain because Theresa May can't get a deal through. And another part of this as well is, I think, if you look at this as Theresa May is the European Union's emissary to the Houses of Parliament, then it all makes sense. She's coming back to the Houses of Parliament with what the EU have told her they want out of this deal. And she has not told them what we want out of this deal at all, because she doesn't know, because she doesn't believe in it. She never has believed in it right from the beginning. And even the negotiators from the EU have said, well, look, we just don't know what Britain wants out of this. I mean, all we've heard that Britain wants out of this is to guarantee the rights of the European citizens that are already in Britain. That's all I can recall hearing about it. And we've heard as how we still want to have a unified law with the human rights law and the workers' law, basically. We haven't heard anything about how, well, we want to be separate from the European Union. We want to break off from all of their laws. We want the power to make our own laws again. We want the power to guard our borders. We want the power to say who we want to let in here, who we don't want to let in here. We don't want to have to let in people claiming they're refugees when they've travelled through 10 or 15 different countries to get it. We want the power to deport the people that commit crimes in our countries that are from foreign lands. We want the powers to deport them straight back. We don't want to be forced to listen to their appeals and have them appealing to human rights law and laws that don't even apply in their own countries. Nobody has been standing up and saying, well, this is what we want. All we've heard is about guaranteeing the rights of European citizens and what the EU want and how it's all going to be absolutely terrible if we leave without a deal. Yet 90% of the rest of the world managed to get by perfectly well with the World Trade Organization tariffs. And then, of course, once you're on those tariffs, you can then arrange to change the tariffs at your leisure. You know, we could just leave, say, right, we're on World Trade Organization terms, and then we could do the deal that we want with Canada, we could do the deal that we want with the USA, we could do the deal that we want with either with the EU as a bloc, or we could do it with the individual European countries. I mean, it would be so simple. And yet what they've done is they've made it as complicated as possible. Their basic will is to frustrate the will of the people. And there's another point to this as well. I think just one more thing I'll say here, Max. Just one more point here is that these votes, where they voted against taking no deal off the table and voting to stay within the EU, I mean, that may be that they just want a record for the future that they didn't want this. They didn't want this. They tried to stop it, but it was forced through because of law, which means that it just leaves them free to completely frustrate things, sabotage things, and then say, well, you should have listened to us. We said we didn't want it. We even voted to stop it, but public feeling was against us. So that's another thing that I think we can add to this.
Yeah, I think that point you made about the way that all these things have been done to frustrate us. And if you look at the output from the media, the media, interestingly, five national daily newspapers campaigned for Brexit prior to the actual referendum. And my belief is that it was the fact that they did that together with the entire Murdoch media Empire were campaigning for Brexit, and my belief is that it was largely because of the support of that section of the media that the enough British people turned out and realised that there was a possibility of us getting a Leave vote through, and so then went forward and voted for what they really wanted. Ever since the referendum, the media have been unremittingly negative about everything to do with the possibility of us leaving the European Union. It's been constantly leaving on World Trade Organization terms, hasn't been called a clean break Brexit or a World Trade Organization terms Brexit. It's always been described as a no deal Brexit, or it's been described as crashing out, as if something atrocious is going to happen. And we've had this constant Project Fear, where all sorts of spurious things have been put forward as to, you know, these are going to be the dire consequences for Britain if we have a no deal Brexit, if we crash out of the European Union without a deal, and all the emphasis has been on the fact that we have to have a special deal. We can't, you know, can't leave the European Union without having a specially negotiated deal. And of course, the European Union negotiators know that, you know, their interests are served by us not having a deal, because they know the media are going to soften up the public, so that if there is another referendum, then there's a strong possibility it might go the other way. And that's obviously what the MPs that are pro-Remain have been hoping for, and what our government have been hoping for, that if we can be manoeuvred into a situation where we either have to accept continued membership of the European Union or Brexit in name only, and we're prevented from going down the avenue of having a Brexit on World Trade Organization terms, then they're hoping that they can hold a second referendum, and having browbeaten the British public for 2.5 years, as they have with Project Fear, that their hope obviously is going to be that enough people have either been bored to death by the whole thing, because that is a big factor in all of this as well, but not perhaps if not bored to death, then have had the fear of God put into them as to what's likely to happen if we vote to leave the European Union again. And this is the classic ploy used by the European Union whenever there have been referenda in the past in other countries with regard to things like the various additional parts to the European Union Treaty, or whether it was to create the European Union Constitution. You know, whenever a country has voted no or voted against the wishes of the Eurocrats, we've then had a period of Project Fear, where the public in that country have been browbeaten in the same way that we've been browbeaten over the last 2.5 years, and it's been done until eventually the people in that country have caved in. So there must be a massive amount of resentment amongst the common people of the other European Union countries as a result of them having been treated like that in the past, and them having witnessed other member countries being treated in the same way. And sooner or later, there's got to be a groundswell of people who are just going to say, you know, hurrah for the British people voting against Brexit, hurrah for all the other people that in the past have stood up against the tyranny of the European Union, because that's effectively what it is. It's a bureaucratic tyranny, and whenever there is a decision made by the people of any member state or by the people of the European Union in general, the bureaucracy, the quagmire of bureaucracy descends, and all sorts of legal impediments are brought forward to slow down any move towards doing something that European Union doesn't like, and the Project Fear clicks up a gear, and the Eurocrats work together to frustrate the democratic wishes of the people. And that's, you know, a lot of people have spoken about the need for us to have a deal, a trade deal, as if trade is the biggest thing. But all along, for me, the biggest detraction and the most unattractive aspect of our membership of the European Union has been the fact that the European Union is so patently, obviously, undemocratic. And that is the thing that people across Europe have got to identify and that they've got to decide to act upon. You know, how many people have striven, how many people have sacrificed and sacrificed their lives to fight for democracy across Europe, and now we've got one generation, we're giving it all away and we're allowing the creation of a bureaucratic tyranny, a dictatorship effectively, of globalists to actually put us in a position where we can be exploited and where we're left powerless to resist them.
Well, I think, you know, from the people that I talk to, I think, you know, if they did have another referendum, it would be a landslide victory for people wanting to leave. And the reason for that is, up until 2 years ago, people really weren't that aware of just what the European Union was, just what these personalities were, people like Donald Tusk and Claude Juncker. I mean, we just didn't know who they were. I mean, these people were completely unelected. They're former leaders. I think one of them is a former leader of Poland. One of them is a former leader of Belgium. Nobody voted them in to be the president of the European Union. These are the people that are the president of the European Union Commission. And they're the guys that were always in the background before. They're the ones that just gave out these diktats. You will do this. And then our elected European Union members of parliament would then be in the European Parliament. They would get 5 minutes to speak. Wonderful. They all get 5 minutes to speak, but they haven't actually got any power to make any changes to what they've just been told they must enact. So they get to have a little talk. They get to blow off a bit of hot air, and then they all have to sign it regardless. They have no input on what they've been told they have to do by the European Commission. And I think people didn't realize that until seeing it in the last 2 years and seeing the way that the this commission, this Claude Juncker, the drunkard, and Donald Tusk and all the rest of them, they just make these orders and just Britain apparently has to go along with it. They say, well, you're going to have to pay 40 billion euros before you can leave. I mean, that's not anywhere in Article 50. That was just dreamt up by them. That was just some fine that they wish to fine the British people for. We were told that we would be saving all this money if we left them.
That was modern day Danegeld, and it reveals the European Union behaving kind of like a protection racket, where you either pay us this amount of money ad infinitum, or we punish your country economically in response. And again, this is another one of the unattractive aspects of the European Union, the fact that that they've tried to extort this money out of us without giving us anything for it. They've extorted this money out of us in response for us having the opportunity to negotiate a trade deal with them. It's not, you know, the 40 billion euros isn't for us to have a trade deal on attractive terms or anything of that sort. There's no specific, nothing is specified as far as what a trade deal must be. But they've got their money, they've got their Danegeld up front, and that's another sort of aspect of all this.
Well, they're saying that if we end up staying in the EU, they're going to charge us 1 billion euros a month for staying in there. So I think they're trying to say, well, that's a little bit less than the 40 billion euros we were going to demand from you to leave. So you've got all this money that they're taking for absolutely nothing. I mean, London is the financial centre of the world. Everything has to pass through London. You can't cut London out of it, basically. You know, we talk about the negative influences that has and the centre of usury and the centre of banking, but it you cannot take away from that fact that London is the centre of the financial world, and they should be paying us in order to be doing business there, not us paying the EU. I mean, the EU does what the City of London tells it to. The City of London doesn't want to invest. That's it. You know, I mean, it's the Rothschild banks and all of it is centred there. So to think that, you know, we have to actually pay the European Union to do a deal, it's a nonsense. it's a big scam. The hood has been put over the people's eyes. We've been blindfolded from seeing what is really going on. Now, we said about this second referendum. There's been talk of a second referendum. Apparently, that's been held back. I mean, Labour were talking about that. They were saying, well, maybe we should have a second referendum. But I think three quarters of the Labour supporters said that they don't want that. There's also been 16 Conservative associations have written to Theresa May saying you need to get out on March the 29th and you need to leave office. You have failed everyone. There is no faith in the Conservative Party anymore. I think there are 100 Conservative MPs where the deselection process has been started. There's one of them that has already stepped down. I mean, the government is falling apart. I mean, it really does need something very, very drastic to happen to right things. I think that needs to be leaving with a World Trade Organization tariffs on the 29th of March and then a general election after. I mean, it's been done then. They can have a clean break. Okay, clean break. Britain's left the EU. What do we do now? We'll have a vote, and whoever wins that vote, they can then direct proceedings from then on. I mean, they may say, well, we want to look at rejoining the EU. But at least we would know then that we had actually left and we had somebody that was in government that actually had a mandate from the people. Because at the moment, there's no mandate from the people for Theresa May. She's got no mandate from her own party. She cannot get enough votes to get her own deal through Parliament. This has happened twice now. Now she's saying she's going to blackmail everybody by putting it through a third time. And if we don't vote for it the third time, then we end up staying in the EU. I mean, the woman should be forced to leave office for doing that, for arranging that the government to be put into that position. Because it's basically blackmailing them to go along with her deal, which keeps us tied to the EU anyway, but without any say at all in what goes on there. We're still a part of the customs union. We're still a part of everything with Theresa May's deal. It's dreadful. And she hasn't negotiated anything for the British people. And I can well understand why nobody supports it. Now, a lot of the MPs, a lot of the Conservative MPs are saying, well, look, you know, we just have to face this out. Even if we end up staying in the EU for another 2 months or for another 6 months, maybe even for another 2 years, at least that will be better than Theresa May's deal. I mean, it really is that bad. But to think that we're now having to rely on the EU in order for us to leave, i.e. one of the heads of their countries has to veto this motion to allow us to stay, is just unthinkable. I mean, once again, we are at the beck and call of the EU, even of whether we actually leave or not. We're at the beck and call of the EU now. And also, I think what this has done, this has destroyed any faith of democracy in all these other countries in the EU. They've seen what's going on. Their Eurosceptic parties, they've become more powerful over this. And what they are seeing is that it's impossible to leave the EU. Nobody can actually leave. When you do, if you do have a referendum and everybody says that they want to leave, 3 years later, they still won't be able to leave. I mean, democracy, the idea that it's democratic, I think, has really been shown up all the way around Europe. There's nobody that can believe that the European Union is democratic after seeing the shambles that's gone on with Britain trying to leave. And I also think it's shown the failures of having women leaders as well. If you look at the haggard, absolutely haggard state of her last week, where she's unable to even speak, her voice is just a croak, where she doesn't have the stamina required to be doing these deals, to be staying up all night and all the concentration that's required. She just doesn't have it. She's falling apart. She's like, you know, the Walking Dead. It's, you know, I wouldn't be surprised, you know, if she dropped down with some serious illness very soon. I mean, she does look that drained.
Oh,
yeah, well, she's that drained. I mean, nobody in the mainstream has pointed
this out. I saw a bit of video of her today, actually, and she was tottering across the stage at one of these meetings, and she just looked so Well, not necessarily aged, but she just looked as if walking for her was incredibly difficult. And it was noticeable when you compared the work, you know, her gait to the other people that she was meeting with. And so I think that, yeah, there is something to be said for, you know, for what you're saying. And it must be. Setting aside the fact that we're diametrically opposed to what Theresa May wants to achieve in Europe, you have to have a certain amount of, grudging admiration for the fact that she's like flogged herself to the extent that she has, that it's actually sort of aged her to the extent that it has. And I think that that's something that if you are a leader of people and you are leading the people honestly, the leadership of your people becomes an invigorating factor in your life, and something that actually keeps you strong and keeps you alert and helps you to retain energy. Whereas if you are leading a corrupt pile of bureaucratic nonsense, then all of the, you know, and where your government is like a sack full of ferrets, it becomes a very draining and tiring process. And it's noticeable when you look at American presidents as well, that, you know, after sort of 4 years in office, most of them have gone completely grey if they weren't grey beforehand. And it's the, you know, the fact that they're having to do all of these sleazy backroom deals in order to keep themselves ahead of the game, and where they're having to kowtow to all these vested interest groups, and working 24 hours a day, barely getting any sleep, not getting anything substantial in the way of exercise, and they just age, and I think that's a symptom of the fact that what they're doing is utterly corrupt. And the corruption of what they're doing, you know, manifests itself in their physical appearance and in that way.
Oh, yeah. If they had the goodwill of the people, you know, they would be like Bashar al-Assad, who doesn't appear to have aged at all over the last 6 years or however long that war's been going on over there. The man hasn't aged at all. And yet, if you look at Theresa May, her skin is grey. She's covered in wrinkles. I think she's aged at least 10 years during this process.
And she has this habit of gurning as well, doesn't she?
Yeah.
There are lots of photos of her on the internet. If you Google Theresa May and you look at images of Theresa May, there's such a high proportion of them where she's pulling the most grotesque faces. And you can see it when she's speaking. If you've got if she's got a camera on her and she's being videoed, as she's speaking, you can see her, you know, various muscles in her face are twitching, almost like a nervous tick. And if you like freeze frame, that's where they get all these gurning pictures from. They're freeze frames taken from, you know, where she's speaking, and she's got this kind of facial tick where she's, presumably it's where, you know, there's a disconnect between what she's thinking and what she's actually saying. That's the only thing you can sort of think of, really.
Oh yeah, I would suggest that is because she's going against all her natural female instincts. She's going against all her instincts. She's done that all her life. She's tried to be like a man instead of like a woman. She doesn't have any children. She's doing a man's job. She's struggling. She can't do it. And instead of accepting I can't do it, handing it over to someone else, she's still continuing. And that goes against, I would suggest that goes against, female instinct to be doing what she's doing, and her inner soul is screaming in pain at what she's doing to it, and that's why her face is all twisted up and distorted and it's in a grimace, because her real self is saying, well, what the hell are you doing? What have you done with your life? You know, this is not an achievement, what you've done. I mean, when you look at what the other female politicians, they say, oh, but she's tried so hard. She tried so hard for this deal. Andrea Leadsom says this a lot. Oh, but she's worked so hard. She tried so hard. We should support it. But that's not a reason to support something just because somebody has tried hard at it. You know, you should support something if it does the job, if it does what it's supposed to do. And her deal doesn't do what it's supposed to do. But half the women in Parliament will support her just because they think, well, she's tried hard. Again, this is a, you know, this is a natural female way of thinking, which is good for raising children. You want to be encouraging children to do their best, and what they've done may not actually be the best, but the mother will tell a little white lie and say, oh yes, you've done really well, and that's fantastic there, and it's just a natural motherly way. But that's not what you want in politics. It's not what you want in politics, especially not doing deal making as well. When you think about deal making, when you listen to the feminists on the television and they explain why women don't earn as much as men, one of the main reasons they suggest for it is that women are no good at doing deals. They're no good at pushing for what they want for themselves, because they're far more used to trying to play the peacemaker and trying to compromise, and they're just not used to it. And again, and we've got somebody who's supposed to be doing, you know, the most important deal of the last 50 years, and we've got a woman doing it. We've got somebody with no experience at deal making in her life before. We've got somebody that's just got to where she's got to, but because she happens to be a woman that's doing a job that's normally done by men, and because of this drive towards equality, they've jumped on that and said, oh yes, let's promote Theresa May so we can say that we support feminism and we support equality and we've got a woman prime minister. Never mind the fact that she's absolutely incompetent and she's not actually capable of doing the job. She's had, She's had a vote of no confidence. She's had the biggest loss ever in the history of Parliament, trying to get her withdrawal deal through. Twice now she's failed it. She's going to try and push it through a third time. These are all things that are absolutely unheard of before. And nobody's pointing out the fact that, you know, partly this is due to the fact that she is a woman and women are different to men, and she shouldn't be in that position that she is in. And this plays out everywhere where they push these diversity quotas and they lower the standards and they put people in positions that they shouldn't be in just so that they can say, well, we support equality. And you've got some very, very important positions like the role of prime minister where they can do serious damage. And this woman has done serious damage, and she shows no sign of stopping yet. I mean, she's careering on ahead, just like repeating herself over and over again, trying to push this deal through. Doesn't work the first time, we'll try it again a second time. Doesn't work the second time, we'll try it again a third time. We'll try blackmailing them alongside it with the third time and say, well, if you refuse to vote for it, we'll stay in the EU. And she's just desperate to get this deal through. I wonder if the EU haven't said, well, if you get this deal through and you step down, we'll give you a job at Goldman Sachs, or we'll do like we did with Tony Blair and make you a peace envoy in the Middle East, or some such high-flying job that they probably offered her. But anyway, we will keep following this. It does seem to be going in the way that we thought it was going to go, although I hadn't foreseen that she would start blackmailing the members of parliament to actually vote for her withdrawal deal again. And as I say, I think what we should be hoping for now is for one of the member states of the EU to veto this proposal to lengthen Article 50 and to keep Britain in, because that's all we can really hope for now is Salvini or Orban voting this down. But we have got some other news, and really, I mean, go on, Max, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, one thing I was just going to add is that one thing we need to bear in mind throughout all of this, though, is that we have an unwritten constitution as far as the UK is concerned. It's not a written constitution, but one of the guiding principles of that constitution is that the British Parliament is sovereign and that no British Parliament can bind a future Parliament. That's one of the key principles of the British Constitution. And so no matter what the outcome of these negotiations, if we manage to get a nationalist government elected at some point in the future, then we will be able to just renounce any obligations that we've been placed under as a result of, you know, Theresa May's incompetence or anybody else's incompetence. We don't have to be bound by it. There is no, within our constitution, there is provision for any new parliament that we get elected to renounce the bad things that have been arranged for us by past parliaments. So that should be a source of inspiration for us, and something for us to work towards as we work towards getting a nationalist government.
Oh, yeah, that is certainly a good to know. There are a lot of things, actually, in our laws that are actually very well thought out and should have prevented the situation that we're in today. I mean, things like juries, 12 men on a jury. If there was a law that was unconscionable, that shouldn't be there, then those 12 men on the jury should say. And you would think that that would actually hold in check tyrannies such as the hate speech laws and the anti-incitement to racial hatred laws. You would think that people would stand up and say, well, no, this law isn't right. It impinges on free speech. I mean, that's why they said, well, we'll have 12 people judging this. Then they'll be your judge. They'll be your peers. They'll be people from your own background. And there's lots of things like that in law, like the thing that you just suggested there, Max, that, you know, that a new parliament is sovereign and it can undo all the messes and mistakes of a previous one. So we just need to get a nationalist party in there. But yeah, there are other news stories. There's a major news story in New Zealand, and we do try to cover mainly British news here, but this is affecting things in Britain. Somebody's been arrested in Britain, apparently for wrongthink in a tweet. I think they supported the actions of the killer over there in New Zealand. The news today is saying that apparently Brenton Tarrant, I think his name was, he was actually in Britain for 2 weeks. And the MI5 and the British police are obviously very interested in that to find out what he was up to. So I'm very thankful that nobody in the Radio Aryan chat room has said anything silly or voiced any support for the massacre over in New Zealand. And I would hope none of our listeners would either, because the police will clamp down on you. As I say, they have already arrested somebody for words such as that on Twitter. But there are a couple of things that I think ties in with Britain with this news story. Sadiq Khan put police officers outside every mosque in London. And there were three stabbings over the weekend, or at least three, just three that I've read about. It may even have been three murders. But he was able to actually put police on the doors of all the mosques, but he wasn't actually able to police the streets. And when the bomb went off at the Manchester Arena and it killed all those children and maimed dozens more, the nail bomb went off. After that, they put police officers outside all the mosques. So whether it's white people that get killed or whether it's brown people that get killed, it's police officers outside all the mosques. They didn't put police officers outside any of the pop concert venues. They haven't put police officers outside the UKIP office or assigned extra police to Tommy Robinson after this killing went off in New Zealand. They haven't reassured nationalists that this is the actions of one individual and we mustn't tar the whole of nationalism with this horrific act, like they do every single time when it's Muslims that are attacking white people. Once again, when you look at the vigil, it's all white faces at the vigil in New Zealand, and the same as when it was white people killed over here by Muslims, it was all white faces. And another thought that I've had on this over the weekend as well is when this guy went into the mosque and shot people. I mean, he shot, what, 50 people? He killed 50 people. Contrast that with what went on in the Bataclan, where they cut off people's testicles, fed them into, made people eat them, disemboweled people, gouged their eyes out, basically horrifically tortured them to death, so much so that the investigators were throwing up and bawling their eyes out upon actually seeing the horrific carnage that had taken place. And Fraser Anning, a great politician from Australia, he pointed this out, that the majority of times something like this happens, it's Muslims doing it to whites. And this is the one and only time that there's been a massacre by a white man of Muslims. And that's not to justify it, but it's to actually put it into perspective. And of course, there's been lots of calls for him to step down. Somebody threw an egg at him and he turned around and thumped him, which I thought was great. I'm sure most of our listeners have probably already seen that. But just, really, I think what we should take from this is just be careful what people are saying on Twitter and put it into perspective. And thankfully, we have had a mainstream figure, Fraser Anning, has put it into perspective. And that was his comment on this. And he's become very notorious for it. That's really my views on it, Max. I spoke a lot about this on Friday, so I'll pass it over to you for your thoughts on this massacre in New Zealand.
Okay, the first thing I'd like to point out is something you've intimated already, which is that whenever there is an atrocity carried out by an Islamic extremist, the government always point out that these kind of acts are carried out by a very, very small minority of Muslims. And they go to the extent of inventing a kind of Islam which isn't actually regular Islam. And what they've done is the government of, I think it was actually, it might have even been David Cameron's government that came up with this, where they've started referring to the radical Islam as Islamism. So that they've invented something which didn't actually exist. The Islamic terrorists that carried out the atrocities that have been carried out never differentiated themselves from Islam by calling themselves Islamism. It was something that the government came up with. And yet whenever there is a right-wing extremist who carries out an atrocity like this, that there's no comparable distinction between people who are homicidal maniacs on the extreme right and the vast majority of ordinary law-abiding citizens on the extreme right. There is no comparable concept of there being a good nationalist. The government haven't invented nationalism-ism to differentiate nationalism-ism from nationalism in the way that they've invented Islamism to differentiate Islam from Islamism. Which demonstrates a double standard there, and it demonstrates a willingness on the part of the government to constantly apologise for excesses that are carried out in the name of Islam, but not to apologise similarly for excesses that are carried out in the name of nationalism. And what I would say also about the actions of this chap, Brenton Tarrant. I don't know what motivated him to do what he did, but it was an extremely foolish and stupid thing for him to have done. And I would urge anybody who's having any kind of similar thoughts to desist from giving in to those thoughts, because it doesn't do anything for our cause. And in the fact that Brenton Tarrant has published a manifesto, you know, couched in all kinds of really right on staunch words and all this sort of thing, you know, it means nothing, because what he's done is he's just set back the cause of white nationalism in New Zealand by several years, and he would have set back the cause of white nationalism across the world by several years, because instead of just objecting to third world immigration and unrestricted third world immigration in a civilized way, in a way which registers your objection to third world immigration to the country and does so in a way that other people can find rational and admirable, what he's done is he's done the most extreme thing he could possibly do, knowing that that extreme thing that he's doing is going to will be completely and utterly counterproductive, and that's the stupidity of it. Nobody's going to look at the senseless murder of 50 Muslims and think, oh yeah, that's now set the country to rights, because people aren't going to do that. What's going to happen is that the media are going to feed off of those 50 dead people, and they're going to use those 50 dead people to smear another whole generation of white nationalists in New Zealand and prevent anybody from talking sensibly and rationally about the sinful act of allowing mass immigration into Western countries from the third world. And that's what we've got to concentrate on. We've got to concentrate people's minds on pursuing a strategy that has a constructive and a positive end that serves our purposes, not doing something which is just an extreme, you know, hey, look at me, aren't I cool, look, I've just killed a load of immigrants. You know, what a stupid thing to do. And it's not going to convince anybody else who's not yet on our side to come over to our side. They're just going to view him as a homicidal maniac, and they're going to, you know, under the influence of the media, they're going to view us all and tar us all with the same brush. And so, as I say, nobody should consider doing something like this, because and what infuriates me is that these people, they always chicken out at the end. You know, he had a gun, he had several guns, he watched through mosques just shooting people, and then when he was confronted by the police, he just gave himself up. So now he'll go off to a cozy prison cell somewhere where he'll be treated as some kind of a celebrity, when in reality, you know, he's done an incredibly stupid and wicked thing, and should be despised by all right thinking people for what he's done.
It certainly hasn't done us any favours. All it will do is turn people off. It will turn people off nationalism, because they will see that it's associated with that. Obviously, I agree with everything that you said there, Max. We do our best here at Radio Aryan to prevent people from carrying out any violent acts. You know, we should act within the law. But one thing we can do is point out the difference in the way that this attack is treated from other attacks. I mean, there was, I forget who it was from. I think it was from somebody in Syria. And they pointed out that in actual fact, there are attacks like this on Christians every week. Every week there are, you know, multiple numbers of Christians that are slaughtered in their churches in places like Nigeria, places like Syria. I mean, ISIS were doing this. ISIS was slaughtering Christians while they were at churches. They were beheading them, crucifying them, doing all sorts of horrific things to them. It regularly happens in Nigeria. We hear of bombs going off in churches, and we don't hear anything. We don't see anything about it on the mainstream media. We don't see politicians walking around holding crucifixes like we'd see the New Zealand Prime Minister walking around with a head shawl on, showing her solidarity with the Muslims. We don't see anything like that about Christians that are being massacred. And I think it's something like 160 times more likely to be murdered if you're a Christian than if you are a Muslim. I was looking at some statistics that were in an article yesterday. I should have refreshed my memory of it before coming on today. But it made some very, very good points that, you know, about putting this into perspective, and the way that the media is going crazy about it and saying we've got to shut down right-wing commentators, and it's nationalists talking about this. It's people like Alex Jones, Tommy Robinson. I mean, that's a nonsense. I mean, this guy's own manifesto says what it was that radicalized him. He was in Europe at the time when that young girl, the deaf girl, she was run over in the truck attack in Stockholm that killed dozens of people. I think it was about 90 people. And this one little girl was run over. She was deaf. She couldn't get out of the way. Horrific. Absolutely horrific. And nobody saw her picture. We all saw the picture of the Turkish lad whose father stupidly put him on a boat because he wanted to get his teeth done for free in Germany, and his body washed up on a beach. And the whole world saw pictures of that. Nobody saw pictures of this Swedish girl. Nobody remembers her name. Most people remember the name of this Turkish boy, but they don't remember the name of the Swedish girl. And that's what he saw happen. And then he went to France and he saw that Marine Le Pen didn't get in. Macron got in, and look at what France is doing now under Macron. He was right to say, well, they voted for the wrong person. And then he also went round the French villages and realized that the non-whites actually outnumbered the whites that were in these villages. That's what radicalized him. That's what radicalized him. It wasn't listening to people like Tommy Robinson. I mean, straight after this attack happened, there was a journalist outside the trial where Tommy Robinson was taking the police to court. Unfortunately, he lost, but I think we all knew he was going to lose taking the police to court. And there was, I think it was a Sky TV reporter that was outside trying to link Tommy to this attack in New Zealand, because part of this guy's manifesto, he mentioned Darren Osborne, the chap with learning difficulties who hired a van, went to Finsbury Park Mosque and ran a Muslim over. A big thing was made about it, that it was a huge terrorist attack, but it was actually only one Muslim that died, and he died of a heart attack, I think, rather than being run over. But the point of it being that when he was actually in court, the newspapers all reported that the judge said that he was radicalized by Tommy Osborne. He was radicalized by Tommy Osborne's Twitter account. And because this guy in New Zealand had mentioned this Darren Osborne, Sky or ITV or whatever it were, they were drawing this tenuous link to Tommy Robinson. But the fact is that actual trial, the transcripts of the trial that the press reported, the judge said that he was radicalized by Tommy Robinson. The judge didn't say anything like that. That's not actually in the transcript of the trial. The judge didn't draw any links between Tommy Robinson and Darren Osborne going out and killing Muslims. That was made up by the mainstream media. Since then, it's been repeated in the Houses of Parliament by MPs. It's been repeated like Chinese whispers in all the mainstream media. And now you end up with them harassing him outside of court, asking him whether he feels responsible for what this guy's done right the way over the other side of the world in New Zealand. And I just think, you know, that just shows you the sort of lies that the mainstream media are putting out. It's all that sort of thing that makes people think, well, there's no hope, is there? We've got no nationalist parties. We've got no mainstream media journalists that treat us with respect, that talk about our ideas. When we say there's a white genocide that's going on, we're being replaced. They mock that. They say that it's a conspiracy theory. And people just think, well, there's no hope, is there? There's no hope. I might as well go out and do something crazy because we're not going to get anywhere legally. And that's the mindset that people end up with when you censor the nationalist conversation, when you deplatform all the nationalist parties, when you allow groups like Hope Not Hate to stalk nationalists and try to get them to lose their jobs and lose their homes. And try to, physically attack them as well. When you have a government that allows things like that and tries to shut down all debate and all dissent, people end up thinking, well, what else can we do? They've backed us into a corner. We can't do anything legally. We can't do anything lawfully. And that's when you get these violent acts occur, because the debate has been shut down. I firmly believe that.
But going out and attacking a load of immigrants who are seemingly unconnected with unconnected and innocent isn't going to achieve things either. You know, you may be very frustrated about what the government are doing. You may be frustrated about the fact that we are no platformed and that we don't and that we are subject to all sorts of harassment, etc. However, going out and shooting a load of immigrants in a mosque isn't going to change that one iota. All it's going to do is to make it is to make the situation even worse. Now, I mean, what you've got to consider is what is going to be the consequence of what you're doing. And there is something else that you can do. The other thing that you can do is to do what we at Western Spring advocate, which is to work within the community in which you live. And I've been advocating community activism for quite some time. Now, work within the community that you're in order to gain influence locally. As far as elections are concerned, we shouldn't stand nationalist candidates, because nationalist candidates are disparaged and slandered and smeared in the media. What we should do is to employ entryism in order for us to gain influence within the existing main two political parties, with a view to changing the way in which those two political parties act when they're in power. And if we can, at a grassroots level, get enough people that think like us into the Labour Party and into the Conservative Party, we may have to hold our noses to a certain extent because of the stink of corruption and decay that exists within those two parties now. It may be that we might have to publicly pay lip service to their currently corrupt policies, until such time as we can influence them and turn those organisations into something more wholesome and healthy. But that is the way to do it, because that is a way in which the media can't smear us without smearing the main two political parties. If they're not going to smear the main two political parties, then the people that we put forward will eventually get elected. And if we work at a grassroots level intensively enough and get enough people into the local Labour Party and Conservative Party constituency organisations, then we can have a bottom-up revolution in British politics that will be entirely peaceful and entirely legal. And we just need to devote ourselves to that rather than going off and just deciding you're going to shoot a load of people that is going to do nothing for our cause and be completely and utterly counterproductive and just feed ammunition to the likes of Hope Not Hate, who, you know, who just exist to denigrate us and to smear and to tell lies about us. And that is the way forward. It's interesting that, going on to what I was saying about how the way in which the government have invented this term of Islamism in order to draw a distinction between the terrorists and the majority of Muslims that they categorise as just Islamic, and the fact that they don't invent another category for right-wing terrorists and call them followers of nationalismism. It's interesting that the media tried to create this impression that there is some kind of a sinister international right-wing conspiracy amongst white nationalists. And if you compare that with the situation with regard to the Jewish community, it's regarded as anti-Semitic and a racial smear for people to suggest that there is an international Jewish conspiracy against people of other races. And yet, apparently, it's perfectly okay to allege that there is an international conspiracy of white people against other races. And again, this is a double standard. And we need to just speak out about the fact that there is this alleged conspiracy on the part of white nationalists. You know, there is no international white nationalist conspiracy against other races. And we should claim the same protection that the Jewish community does when they claim that suggestions of an international Jewish conspiracy are racial discrimination and a racial smear. We should claim that the allegations of a conspiracy against us is a racial smear as well.
Well, if we had advocacy groups, like the Jews have their own advocacy groups, if we had nationalist organisations, white nationalist organisations dedicated to preserving white people and the way that immigration is affecting white people, he would have had an outlet for his activities. He could have joined these organisations. He could have been a part of doing something like that. He could have used his energies, you know, building something rather than destroying something. That's the point, you know, that I think needs to be made. And as you pointed out there, they will allege that there's this vast right-wing conspiracy. Well, where are the white nationalist parties then? Where's the white nationalist party of New Zealand? Where's the white nationalist party of Britain? We don't have one. We don't have one because the press have destroyed it, because they conspired to destroy the BNP and the National Front, and they allow groups like Hope Not Hate to proliferate. And when you don't have an outlet, when you realise what is going on, when you realise what's being done to our race, you know, you want to do something to prevent it. And you get people that, they're just like, got to do something, got to do something, got to do something. And they go and do something crazy like this, which does us no help at all. But if there was something there, something productive that they can contribute to, then that energy would be used in that way. I mean, you've got the Northwest Front in America. You know, that's a good organisation. But we don't have anything similar yet in Britain. And obviously there was nothing like that in New Zealand. But instead of doing that, instead of saying, well, hang on, we've got to facilitate this conversation. We can't just clamp down on it and try and silence it, because there's just going to be, you know, violence is just going to ensue from it. And instead of saying that, they're doing specifically the opposite. And they're saying, well, we can't allow people to talk about it. We can't allow people to have their views heard on platforms. They're just going to do more deplatforming because of this, which is no help at all. It's entirely counterproductive. We're just going to see more attacks like this, I think, if they clamp down on right-wing speech and nationalist speech. Anyway, obviously, we will keep following this story, as we will the Brexit story. Thank you very much for coming on today, Max. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next Monday with more Aerian Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you all have a great week ahead of you.
Alternative to the anti-white system on RadioArian.com.